Hello, faithful listener, and welcome to this Small Voice podcast. I'm Holly.
And I'm Darren. In this podcast, Holly and I will be reviewing former British politician Rory Stewart's book, Politics on the Edge, which will lead us to a discussion about the difficulties of living with difference and nuance in politics, in the church, and in life in general.
And before we tackle all that, let's do our quick health check. How have you been, Darren?
I have been pretty well, Holly. Not that long back from holiday, my wife Jill and I went to Madeira, which is an island off the coast of North Africa, belonging to Portugal. I have been up a cable car. I have been down the same hill on a toboggan. And I can tell you that the local delicacy, supposedly, in Madeira is fish served with banana. Were you aware of
this?
Oh,
no. That sounds like a terrible idea.
Do you want to know what...
Did you partake?
Well, you've got to try it, haven't you? Do you want to know what it tastes like?
Is it fish and banana?
It basically tastes like, yeah, someone has put fish and banana on your plate. Fish is a local fish, and the banana is a local, very sweet banana. So the fish gets up and walks towards the banana, if you know what I mean, on the flavour profile. So it was interesting to taste it.
No, I have absolutely no idea what you mean.
Well, I mean, it's not a savoury. They don't try and make the banana savoury, so it ends up being quite a sweet dish. So basically, I have come as close as it's possible to tasting fish fingers and custard. And yes, that is a gratuitous Matt Smith Doctor Who reference. How have you been?
Well, no fish fingers and custard for me, unfortunately. And I am a little bit worried that this is another edition of the programme Darren talks about his holidays and Holly moans about how busy she is. But...
People want that as a podcast extra, Holly. They want 20 minutes of that.
I was just me complaining, yes. I have to be honest and say, I mean, there's no nice way of saying it. I'm feeling pretty pummeled by life at the moment. Predominantly busyness and sadness at work. You know, I mentioned before on the podcast that I work in a hospice and it can be pretty sad. But also by quite a lot of sadness in the lives of people that I care about. So I'm okay, apart from mainly that I feel that being busy and particularly complaining about being busy is profoundly dull. So every time I talk about it, I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm just so boring. But, you know, in general, I'm doing all right. I've read a couple of good books recently. So I'm reading the Archbishop of Canterbury's selection of a Lent book this year, which is called Tarry a While by Selina Stone. Which is about black theology and what that can teach the whole church, which is really interesting. And I've just read a book by Oliver Berkman called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals.
Yes.
Which basically tells me that it doesn't matter. I'm never going to get everything done and I need to embrace my finitude. So that's my main aim for this year.
It is an amazing book, isn't it? And that Oliver Berkman basically writes a book that tells you that you don't need self-help books. Well, other than this one that explains that you're never actually going to get the perfect time management technique, which I struggle to cope with. Anyway, on struggles, another update for faithful listeners. We do hope you enjoyed last month's podcast where we chatted about the rise of the algorithm and we shared our struggles with social media addiction. And Holly, I think you'd all but removed yourself from most of your social media presence. So how's it going?
Well, not bad. I'm still off Twitter and Instagram. I'm still off X. Which and Instagram completely, but I realised that in their absence, I started spending about an hour a day on Facebook instead. So I guess what I'm saying is I have a real problem, and I don't even like Facebook. The information I'm getting is like how my granny's friends are doing, and I'm still spending a lot of time on Facebook. So I've logged out. There was some people some of our listeners will know that there was a big Meta Facebook crash in the middle of the week this week.
Oh, right.
So it was down and it logged everyone out. And for a while, I thought that I'd done something that prevented me from logging back in. And I kind of took it as a bit of a sign. So I am, I'm off. I've had to take myself off Facebook too. So tune in next month to find out what I've replaced Facebook with. But Darren, what about you? How's your social media?
I'm just wondering if we can get you like a comfort scroller that's basically some device that you just sit and, you know, I don't know. I'm doing okay. I had set a very challenging target, but the problem is that my phone, I don't understand how my phone works. So once, and I think it's maybe quite deliberate on their part. So once I hit my limit and my little apps get grayed out, you'd think it would be fairly simple to just say, look, no, actually, but particularly with WhatsApp, WhatsApp is counted as social media. And I think actually I've got a message from someone and I need to reply to it, or I was in the middle of replying to it, then I ran out of time. But it's actually really, really hard to sort of work around that. And I think they're just trying to get me to give up completely is the honest thing. So I'm not in as bad a place as you are, I think, Holly, and I'm still not on Facebook. But yeah, I'm still partaking of X for the kind of educational or supposed educational angle. So yeah, anyway, we'll get there. Our thanks to listeners who said they found last month's podcast interesting, even if one of you admitted to falling asleep the first time, as in the first time that you listened to it. So it's good that you came back for more. You did say that it wasn't our fault, and we will choose to believe that. We'd still love to hear your thoughts about social media and the algorithm and how you're getting on with it. So do comment on our website, smallvoice.org.uk, or come find us on Facebook. Holly's not there, but come find us on Facebook or Substack at smallvoice.substack.com.
Yeah, other social media platforms are available. Stay away from them, though. We had a great response to Margaret's latest Small Voice feature about beach wheelchairs, which went out about a week ago now. It's well worth a listen. Visit our website or download from your podcast app if you haven't already. So as we mentioned at the top of the podcast, we're starting our conversation this month by talking about the book Politics on the Edge, a memoir from within, and that's by Rory Stewart. The description of the book from the publisher's website starts, "Over the course of a decade from 2010, Rory Stewart went from being a political outsider to standing for Prime Minister, before being sacked from a Conservative Party that he had come to barely recognise. Tackling ministerial briefs on flood response and prison violence, engaging with conflict and poverty abroad as a foreign minister, and Brexit as a cabinet minister, Stewart learned firsthand how profoundly hollow our democracy and government have become." The website goes on to call the book uncompromising, candid, and darkly humorous, and a remarkable portrait of our age. Darren, that sounds right up our street. What did you make of it?
Well, I was excited to read this book because I'd been holding off buying it until it came out in paperback. And I guess it'll be interesting to see, you know, these political memoirs, sometimes you get a really interesting sort of afterword that you know, will be in the paperback version that isn't in the hardback, but who knows. So obviously we decided that this was a good time to talk about the book, partly because of political events. And, you know, the book has been nominated for a political award, and it will be coming out in the summer in paperback. I do have history with Rory Stewart. I mean, I really like him on the podcast that he co-presents with Alistair Campbell, who's a former, I'll say, Labour spin doctor, and you can flame me on X for using such a cheap metaphor, you know, chief of communications or whatever Alistair was. But actually, it goes further back than that. I read Rory Stewart's book about walking around Afghanistan, and this was, you know, pre-9/11. He's a man who loves a walk, and you will learn this from the book. He loves a good long walk. And it was a really fascinating book when I read the back cover, and it didn't do much for me, sadly. Listening to the podcast, I then thought, oh, I'll listen to his book about his time as a governor in Iraq, you know, after the Iraq war. I listened to that on audiobook and had to listen to it at 1.7 speed because of his slow delivery. And I know you've listened to this one on audiobook, so we'll come on to that. Anyway, I kind of feel this is probably done me now for Rory and the written form, if you like. I like him off the cuff. I like him spontaneous. I didn't find it darkly humorous. If there's a laugh in this book, I confess I missed it. But there are stories in there that would have your jaw on the floor in terms of barefaced lies by Tory politicians, and he names them. The only problem is that my jaw had been on the floor a long time ago and had come back up again because I've sort of heard some of these stories, so I'm not sure that it's as candid and as revelatory as it's been made out to be, other than he seems to be a decent bloke. But what isn't in the book is the kind of so what. He's sort of saying the political system, Parliament in the UK is broken, but it doesn't really tell us how to fix it. Although I'm sure he thinks that he could do it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to confess, this was the first book that I read this year. So I read it the first week in January. And I chose it because I, like you, really enjoy The Rest Is Politics. And I find Rory quite likeable off the cuff, and particularly in conversation with Alistair Campbell. I think that they have something that really works together as a podcast duo. Because I'd read it a wee while ago, and because I, as you said, listened to the audiobook, I didn't have a paper copy to go back to jog my memory. So I went into the notes app that I use, which is an app called Capacities, to see what I'd put in for my review of the book. And I'd only written one word, which is not my usual. And the one word that I'd written was insufferable. And that's... That's not fair. And I think you've kind of alluded to that a little bit. You know, there is stuff in the book that's definitely worth a read, quite interesting. You know, a lot of anecdotes that, you know, if you're a regular listener to the Rest Is Politics podcast, you'll have heard before. But I don't find Rory on that podcast particularly irritating. I mean, he's reasonably pretentious. I think that's fair enough. He's very posh, and poshness grates on me. But I find the Rory of the book, as I said, insufferable, because he talks about taking over different ministerial briefs. And I can summarize them perhaps unfairly as, I took on this role, I knew more than everyone else that I met, and they all eventually recognised that I was right. And then I went for a long walk and thought about it. And then I took over a different ministerial brief, and turns out I knew way more than everyone else about that too. And he seemed to be someone who had a very healthy ego, and that you maybe need that to be a politician, but I found it in autobiography form without a challenge to him. I find that a little bit difficult to read.
And with his impressions of other people.
Yeah, so that was the problem with the audiobook, is that he gave what I found to be quite unflattering impressions of people that he'd crossed paths with. And maybe that's different whenever the person he's talking about is Priti Patel or David Cameron, but whenever it was some unflattering impressions of his Cumbrian colleagues or really anyone Scottish, I find it difficult to listen to, because I thought it kind of betrayed a little bit sometimes what he really thought about these people, and they weren't the most flattering audio portraits, shall we say. But as I say, because I listened to the audiobook, I'm probably a little bit biased towards thinking about things like the audio problem, so the impressions thing, which I find a little bit off-putting. But I, like you say, there are some things there that are probably worth diving into a bit deeper. My worry was that when I started to look at reviews of the book, it seemed like I was reading a different book than everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, it has been praised to the skies. Now, you know, you could say political memoirs are a bit thin on the ground and often are pretty awful. I was just thinking that, you know, the wildly entertaining ones are often by people like Alan Clark, who didn't really do much in government at all. You know, the people who... who are entirely candid and rogues and scoundrels, I guess. I did find it interesting, because it's, you know, chronological order in his time, I did find it interesting revisiting what happened after Brexit, you know, with when Theresa May was trying to get deals over the line, you know, with the EU on, you know, and still having some form of agreed trade, you know, the customs union. And I find that interesting because I remember, and we're coming on to talk about, you know, politics in general and the conduct, if you like, of our politicians. I don't think it was Parliament's finest hour, but I remember, I think I was in America when some of these votes failed and I was kind of cheering on. Now, to be fair, and maybe it's benefit of hindsight, Rory Stewart was trying to get these deals over the line and he was defending Theresa May, who eventually, you know, had to resign. Have I got that right? Or was it a leadership challenge? I think she had to resign. Please come in if I'm wrong. But my point is, if I look back on that and I was cheering for my side, I really wanted the referendum to be run again, you know. And I now recognise that there was no way that was going to happen. And, you know, the Labour Party in opposition could have got a much better deal over the line than we now have, you know. And didn't do it. Now, partly, I guess, Jeremy Corbyn was not necessarily a huge fan of Europe. He was the Labour Party leader at the time. But also it's just more fun to screw things up for your opponent. So I found his portrayal of that interesting in that I thought, with the benefit of hindsight, I was entirely wrong there. You know, there was a more reasonable path that could have been trod, but it was just party politics. I don't know if you feel the same way about that bit or not.
Yeah, I do to an extent. And I think partly I was asking myself the question when I read it and then when I read the reviews, what was it that I didn't like that other people did like? And what was I expecting from the book? And one of the questions I guess I had for myself, particularly around the issues about Brexit, was have I become accustomed to my little corner of the internet that just reflects back to me what I already think? And actually, you know, although there are some things that Rory Stewart and I find overlap in, there are also some things that we don't. And I think that kind of his reasonableness, so the fact that he is, although a conservative and someone who disagrees with me on a bunch of things, he has clearly put some thought into his political opinions, has a nuanced view, is willing to change his mind. And that's not the portrayal of conservatism that is easiest for me to caricature. That I find maybe that challenge of having to listen to someone who disagreed with me, and that maybe comes back to what you were saying about Theresa May and Brexit. And actually, if we were willing to sit down as a nation, or Parliament was able to sit down in such a way that properly discussed the merits of what the best Brexit could look like, rather than just the kind of burn it all down politics that we had at the time. I do think, I agree, we would have come out with something better. But it does mean that we need to be able to hold difference maybe in a different way than we were holding it at the time. Feel like I'm rambling, but does that make sense?
No, that makes complete sense. I mean, you mentioned, of course, that Rory Stewart is a conservative. I'm not sure if he would say that, or maybe small c conservative, in that he's no longer in the party. You know, he had the whip removed from him. Boris Johnson, basically, you know, people who didn't vote his way, they just were expelled from the party. And I think, you know, there's sometimes that talk of what I think they call it, you know, one nation conservatism. And I kind of, it's interesting to hear someone talk about that. And I think The Rest Is Politics has been great for that. And we'll go on maybe to talk about other podcasts in a moment. They talk about disagreeing agreeably. The fascinating thing is, I wonder if over time in their conversations, they actually begin to coalesce. I mean, originally, I maybe expected there to be more friction than there is. And you're right, Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart have got a great kind of rapport, and you know, they play off each other really, really well. And I should say that Rory Stewart, in the Rest Is Politics, they did a feature on Iraq, where essentially you got a long form interview of Alistair Campbell by Rory Stewart, where I think he got more out of Alistair Campbell and more reflection than you would get in more combative kind of frameworks. What am I saying? I think the Conservative Party has kind of moved, and a lot of people who are or were Conservatives find themselves really on the fringes, and that's going to be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yeah, and I think we'll come back, not just today, but I think over the course of this year, to issues of political polarisation, because I think looking across the world, so not just in UK, in the UK context, but obviously in the US and in other places, that idea that the right has moved further right, and that there's issues of the sort of culture wars issues and things, and that sort mm-hmm. of extreme political polarisation that leaves your kind of old-fashioned fiscal conservatives in a position where actually the parties don't represent them anymore. I think that's I'm in danger of sounding a bit like the current British Labour Party. I think it's Keir Starmer who's been talking about this. These aren't the conservatives that your parents voted for, and I think that is probably a decent campaigning line for the Labour Party in terms of actually conservatism, which has a reasonable element to it, is perhaps not thriving at the moment in our current political milieu.
Yeah, I said that Rory Stewart didn't really give solutions, which I think I do stand by. So maybe in the interests of balance, I should point out that Alistair Campbell has a book out in paperback. I think it's called What Can I Do? And it's a sort of, it's a plea for people to get involved in politics, really. So maybe they're an interesting double act, not just in podcasts, but on the book front. I think if you've not read a Rory Stewart book, I would probably encourage you to have a read of it. But if you're a fan of the podcast, you're probably, you know, there's not a huge amount that you don't already know.
Yeah, absolutely. I do plan to read Alistair Campbell's book as well. But, you know, as I said, I think my main thing was I find the Rory Stewart of The Rest Is Politics likeable and affable. And I do wonder whether he is there. They temper each other somewhat. And actually that's probably where the magic formula lies.
Yeah.
Politics on the Edge, a memoir from within, is written by Rory Stewart and published by Jonathan Cape. It's available in hardback, audiobook, as you've heard, and in ebook formats. And as Darren mentioned, will be coming out in paperback this summer.
Okay. So we mentioned the podcast, The Rest Is Politics, when we were discussing Rory Stewart's book. And we found it quite interesting that there are quite a lot of podcasts out just now dealing with politics and this notion maybe of disagreeing agreeably. Just a couple to mention that have only really just started recently. Beth Rigby and Jess Phillips and Ruth Davidson. I have a podcast called Electoral Dysfunction. Beth is a Sky News person. Jess Phillips is Labour and Ruth Davidson is Conservative. Or you can have Saida Warsi of the Conservative Party and David Baddiel, comedian. And they have a podcast just started called A Muslim and a Jew Go There. And it's fascinating to see the popularity, because trust me, Rest Is Politics has phenomenal listening figures, the popularity of just people chatting and not necessarily having a fight and therefore not really being clickbait, but we're not going to talk about social media at the moment. But there does seem to be an appetite for reasonable discussion, and that suggests that maybe people actually do want to talk reasonably about difference, and they are they're open-minded to some nuance. Or am I being too optimistic, Holly?
So I don't think so. I rely quite heavily on political podcasts to keep me up to date with UK news. And there was a long time where there was a little bit of a dearth of decent UK political podcasts that weren't just about Brexit. So we've sort of had the Brexit cast and Romaniacs and things, but not a kind of broad spectrum of political podcasts. And during that time, I was sort of, I'm thinking kind of your sort of 2016 to 2020. I was listening to quite a lot of American podcasts, and one that I've loved for a very long time is Pantsuit Politics with Sarah and Beth. And back in the day, so when they started, they used to identify as Sarah from the left and Beth from the right, although neither of them were what you would describe as left wing or right wing, perhaps in a UK context, but also in a 2024 context. They certainly aren't, and they don't have that anymore. But their whole I guess raison d'etre whenever they started their podcast was about agreeing disagreeably and being able to hold have a nuanced discussion about different aspects of life. And they, you know, they went there about things like, you know, guns and abortion and things that are sort of felt to be very much kind of third rail issues. I guess I'm glad that there are podcasts that address that kind of need for disagreeing agreeably. I'm terribly guilty of just listening to podcasts where everybody agrees with each other on a sort of left wing to sort of center to further left spectrum. So I'm listening to quite a lot of reasonably center left podcasts, The Bunker, Oh God, What Now, that kind of stuff. But I'm interested in electoral dysfunction. I just heard about it today for the first time, so it's being quite heavily promoted. So I was quite keen to listen to that and have a bit.
It's certainly high time we heard some female voices, you know.
Oh, so I mean, certainly. I mean, I hear quite a lot of Marie LeConte because I'm listening to stuff that she contributes to. But I think from it's interesting to see Jess Phillips and Ruth Davidson on that podcast lineup, because it's quite a masculine dominated sphere in the UK, I think.
Old white men, basically.
Yeah, I mean, nothing.
My wheelhouse, you would think.
Nothing wrong with a bit of that, but
there's everything wrong with that.
I kind of wonder though, when I was reflecting on it, whether what there's an appetite for is these conversations to happen in the context of a relationship. So
yes,
so there's something about Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart sitting down and having conversations with each other every single week that means.
And am I right that they'd not really met prior to doing the podcast, had they?
So my understanding is that they certainly weren't pals, and but we've been able to listen to this evolving relationship over time.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned this earlier. I think there is some evidence if you listen to them that there's a greater sympathy for each other's view that has developed over time because they're having these conversations in the context of a relationship. So I'm interested to see how that works with electoral dysfunction, whether those relationships maybe start to spark some conversation and difference. And certainly Saeed Avarzi and David Baddiel, again, having conversations in the context of an evolving and building relationship, I think is... there's something much more honest about that than, political debate or trying to engineer debate in a podcast format.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned the kind of long form interview, which I've just been reading a book about that, really, The Death of That, we can put a link to that in the show notes. Because we want the clip and we want the gotcha moment. But it's interesting, you know, people are listening to podcasts that are an hour, and yet, you know, our news is condensed to 20 seconds, or, you know, a really complicated issue condensed into a couple of minutes. We probably do have to talk about the elephant in the room, though, which I think is part of the reason we wanted to tie this up, is that, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we saw some pretty unedifying behaviour in the UK Parliament, in the House of Commons, on a day when the SNP were having an opposition day debate. Now, forgive us, faithful listeners, we're going to send you in the direction of the Today programme, a podcast, which is Radio 4, for that day. I think it's either the Wednesday, I think it's Thursday, the 22nd of February, when they talk about it, to really get to the ins and outs of it. But basically, it was a debate. The motion from the SNP was calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, but they used particular language, and Labour were worried about backbench rebellion within Labour, so they tabled an amendment, and unusually the Speaker of the House of Commons allowed that to be heard, and it gets way more complicated than that. But if people were putting on their TV screens to watch this, they were literally screaming at each other, and it doesn't do a lot for our politics to see that, because I think there would be a small number, hopefully hardly any people, who don't want to see a ceasefire in Gaza, and yet somehow this just became a whole point of division. And it, I don't know. What did you make of it, Holly?
So just to start by saying, that episode of the Today podcast is called Disgrace, Why Are MPs Playing Politics with the Middle East? And is certainly worth a listen to. And Nick Robinson does a really good, slightly more in-depth explainer of what happened. And they reference a little bit about the sort of traditions of the House of Commons and why it was a big deal and who was playing politics with whom. And I guess also what the Conservative Party's role in that was, because yes. I think it's become very kind of Labour, SNP and the Speaker, but actually there were some stuff that the Conservatives did earlier in the day that is relevant. But I guess in many ways it doesn't, that's not what we want to talk about. We don't want to talk about what happened, because it is wildly complicated and it has to do with like weird minutiae of parliamentary politics. But it just, to me, felt like the worst of us. So it felt like, as you say, it would be the rare person who wouldn't be calling for a ceasefire of some kind in the Middle East. But it's what do we call it? Are we going to say that there should be a unilateral Israeli ceasefire? And it gets sort of very like, oh, but what about this? What about that? What about that? And I think from the outside, and by the time I tuned in to see what was happening, it was just people yelling at each other in Parliament about what was, in the end, what sounded to be quite a minor thing, when what it was meant to be about, or what it felt like it should have been about, was actually this discussion about a ceasefire in Gaza. And it got me thinking, certainly, about how much of our politics are taken up by what feels like squabbles, like kind of childish political squabbles, whenever actually there's some really big issues in the world that these are people whose job it should be to put some thought into how those issues can be solved. And it doesn't feel like we're doing that.
Yeah, so you don't go to Parliament to hear reasoned debate, unfortunately.
No, and I think it's that I've always found, and I'm thinking particularly about Westminster. So I think that that culture of like boos and cheers and hear, hear and all of that, it has this real like public school debate society vibe to it that I've always found very difficult to understand, because in other spheres of leadership and management culture, you know, that wouldn't, you know, it's clear that is not going to get anything done. But no,
imagine if your meetings were conducted that way.
Oh, it would be great. I want to sit on opposing benches and yell at each other. And
two swords lengths apart, so that you can't hurt each other.
I think what I'm saying is that I need a dispatch box for my next board meeting. But it just feels like it is this, the UK Parliament, so the Westminster Parliament, has a really archaic vibe to it in terms of, I keep using the word vibe, but that's I'm going to try and make it sound young and trendy.
That's your jam.
But exactly. But it has this, a lot of traditions, and the way it's set up do not seem to me to actually foster meaningful and useful political debate.
And yeah. And do you think it's better, if we get onto the architecture of the building, you know, famously when the Scottish Parliament was created, we did not want, well, actually, I don't know who it was, the commissioner or whoever, did not want that kind of oppositional setup. You did not want people facing each other. So I'm going to describe it because I think I heard someone clever say today that it's a hemicycle. Is that correct?
I've heard the words branch used to describe parts of the Scottish Parliament. I basically they're not quite sitting in the round, but they're kind of those who are in government and the opposition sit kind of half facing each other.
Yeah, you know, not face to face, if you like.
Yeah, and not in that way where they have to be two swords width apart, because you know.
Do you think that has helped? I mean, we don't get quite the same clips on Rep Scott on Reporting Scotland, BBC One's news programme for Scotland. You don't quite get the same. I guess because they can't pan back and show a two shot of the two people kind of squaring off.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think if you were designing a parliament building today, I don't think anyone would want to design it to be as oppositional as the Westminster Parliament building. I think that architecture is really important, and the way we interact with space changes us. Even thinking about it from a healthcare context, it used to be that you sat across the desk from your GP, but if you've been to a GP more recently, you'll sit at a kind of oblique angle to them at the edge of the desk. It doesn't feel quite as confrontational as it used to. I guess an old-fashioned management style would have you behind your desk very forcefully, and that's not how most managers would choose to lay out their desks now. And I guess that there's that kind of equivalence there where there's something about the fact that you're facing each other down, mm-hmm, that perhaps encourages some of the shouting matches that we see in Parliament. I think there's also just, as I said, the arcane traditions, and it kind of falls quite quickly. That I imagine if you went into Parliament, if I became an MP tomorrow, I would go in saying I would not become like that. Of course, I would never be like that. But I don't know whether if you gave me a couple of years, I would be just guffawing and hearing like the rest of them. It just doesn't feel particularly, as I said, conducive to political debate. There's something about opposition versus, I guess, feeling the feeling of being all in this together and a bit more collegial if you're in the round or in a hemicircle.
Polly Toynbee in The Guardian described the debacle a couple of weeks ago as like watching a grubby game of political chess, and there is that frustration of actually watching people trying to outmaneuver each other, trying to get a win.
Mm.
But leaving aside the architecture, if I'm honest, and I'd have to go back a few years, but I think I've been in church meetings. I've been in churches where that kind of maneuvering went on, I have to be honest. So I don't think that we're completely wrong. We think the politicians are awful and we are fantastic. I do think that there is a problem here.
Yeah, and I guess, don't get me wrong, when I'm saying I find opposition in politics very challenging, as in the way we yell at each other in politics, what I don't mean is I think everybody should agree with each other, because I think political debate, and we'll get onto it in a second, church debate is really important, and actually rubbing each other's rough edges off and being in a relationship with each other that's robust enough to have a good old proper robust discussion, but still walk away from it with both parties intact. And there's something about how do we build a container of a relational nature that's perhaps strong enough to hold that kind of political debate. So I wonder, is that something that needs to be learnt in churches too? I'm interested in the church meetings that you've been in where there were where there's swords.
I think it was, as is probably the case with the House of Commons, it wasn't actually what was going on in the chamber. It was all the manoeuvring that was going on behind doors, and I think probably literally behind doors, behind closed doors in the House of Commons. So I think it was more the manoeuvrings that were going on in church meetings. And you listen, no names, no pack drill, and I am not a saint, but it's quite painful when you think, I think what you're saying there isn't right, and I think you know that that's not right. And absolutely politicians do that, but I think you'd see that in churches as well.
Yeah, so I guess it's helpful to think about what our church backgrounds are. So I come from a Presbyterian background. So we had our elders kind of ran the church. There wasn't a huge amount of congregational involvement in decision making in a church context. And then in my 20s, I joined a Baptist church. So that's a congregationally governed church where the congregation are the decision-making body of the church. And goodness, that is, to me, a much more interesting way of doing church.
I was going to say, that's so much better, is it? It's certainly interesting. Interesting is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
I certainly think at its best, it has potential to be way better and so interesting. And I think, I do truly believe that we, each of us, hold within us a spark of the mind of God, and that when we get together, we can really... we can really get closer to what is the right thing to do as a group of people. But yeah, of course, there's manoeuvrings, and there's strange comments, and there's all sorts of weird conversations that happen in a church context. But I go back to what I was saying a wee bit earlier about how there's something about those podcasts where there's two different sides being represented. When those sides are in relationship with each other and that relationship can hold the debate, I think from a church context, and probably from a political context as well, having containers that are built of relationships that can hold on to lots of opposing views, to me sounds like a healthier thing. Looking at the debates in the church, the broader church, around women in ministry or same-sex marriage or issues of ethics like assisted dying or abortion, that where it seems to fall down is whenever there seems to be one side that feels like they're holding all of the power. And I think if we're able to level out and say we are a group of people who are in relationship with each other and trying to discern the will of God, maybe we would get closer to what we should be doing. But again, as I said, at our best.
Yeah, I'm not talking about church. I'm actually talking more about work. My work in education. What I find fascinating is that I'm not going to say how much that I had a great deal of power in my job, but I went from being a teacher to head of department and then worked at the council. And don't get me started on what people think of you when you say you work for the council. That's a level of complexity I don't want to talk about. But it's fascinating that I think you feel that your hands are more tied. I mean, there's things that we've talked about this before, there's things that your minister might believe, but they're not going to say it at a church meeting. And I don't know how much we can kind of be honest with each other about the times when we disagree. The thing I used to really hate at work, because I could be gobby at times, is putting my point across entirely reasonably,
but forcefully.
And then there is tumbleweed. And then after the meeting, five people come up to me and say, I'm so glad you said that. And I think, but it went nowhere. It went nowhere because no one else would say. It's finding the structures that allow for that honesty. And must be hard in the Scottish Parliament just now, in Scottish Government, with the freedom of information request. That's not to go down that as a blind alley, you know, of just how can we get into a room and have a conversation about this?
Yeah. I think we were talking today in a meeting at work about psychological safety and in the context of some quality improvement work that we're doing around trauma-informed care. And that whenever we say psychological safety in a work context or in a context of a doctor-patient relationship or a nurse-patient relationship, we're talking about some feeling safe that the conversation is a strong enough container to hold all of human life, and to not have to kind of smush yourself into a box and pretend to be something you're not in order to get your point across in conversation. And I think you're right, that's not something that's done particularly well. It's not something that is in any aspect of life, I don't think. But working towards it, I think there's something about having it as an ambition that is good.
And you're right in that if I think of, say, in schools, if I think of the schools where that discussion was able to take place, I inevitably come back to the fact that the quality of the relationship was really, really strong, that, you know, people had done a lot of things together, had got to know each other. And so there was that kind of relationship. I mean, I don't think in a podcast that I... you do kid yourself I feel like I know Rhys Stewart. Well, I don't, you know, let's be fair about that. But listening to him, you know, from conservative background, or listening to people on other podcasts and beginning to see them as a person and not as this, you know, just that's all they are as a politician, or that's all you are as a consultant or whatever. Just realising that they're human. I mean, who knew? Turns out to be a powerful thing.
Yeah, and we talk about that quite a lot in work, that a lot of this kind of highfalutin management speak, you know, by the time you actually boil it down, it does become, you can summarise it all as be a good human. And I guess we when we talked about the Rory Stewart book earlier in the podcast, both said that he offered maybe a lot of problems but didn't offer solutions. So, you know, how do we embrace the different views of others? My wife challenged me this week by asking me in a certain situation whether the issue was that I expected myself of people. So did I expect whenever I went into a situation that they would respond exactly the same way that I would respond, and that whenever I was faced with anything different from that, I was like, oh no, you're doing it wrong. So I guess how do we understand that the person who we are, that's in front of us, is a different person than we are?
Oh God, that's a tricky one, isn't it? I think you have to have space and time. You know, you, of course you have to learn to listen. You know, I saw an interesting quote recently which said that if you're disagreeing with someone, you should be able to understand their point of view well enough that you can explain it to them in a way that they will think is fair, if you like. And that means not kind of labelling them and not immediately thinking that you're this or you're that. But yeah, in terms of expecting people to be, why can't everyone be reasonable like me? I don't know. What was your answer to that, Holly?
Oh, I don't have a great answer. I have, there was someone from my church was leading prayers of intercession a few weeks ago. And he used the phrase, and I'm not sure where it came from or whether he originated it, but he used the phrase, may we see God in others so that they can see God in us. And I think recognizing that, you know, recognizing God in other people, there's something there. And you do it in the midst of, I think you can probably do it while having a screaming argument with that person. But perhaps that's a start.
Yeah, and God is in the regret afterwards, where, you know, you think, oh, you know, I might have been right. We're all guilty of that, but I'm not sure that I kind of acted that well there.
Yeah.
You know,
George, my wife and I talk about one of the things that is transformational in arguments with your spouse is the thought, do I still want to be married to this person tomorrow? And it's amazing what kind of arguments can be ended with that thought. And I do wonder, you know, do I still want to be in relationship with this person enough that I'm going to forgive them what I disagree with? You know, maybe that's a way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for listening to our tentative conclusions on how we can all be better people. I hope you realise that whenever we're saying that, we're talking to ourselves more than we're talking to you, faithful listener. We'll be back in your ears next month with more ponderings on matters moral, ethical and spiritual. Until next time, goodbye for now.
Yeah, bye.